Today's interview is with Kirsten McDermott. Hi, Kirsten.
Hello, Lisa.
I first want to start with how you're enjoying your SwanCon and what's your highlight so far?
Oh, I'm really enjoying it. My highlight, apart from bar, which makes lovely cocktails, I don't know, actually. I went, probably the panels I've been on, because I've only been to a couple that I haven't been on. Mm-hmm. I really, really enjoyed the panel I did yesterday morning about social media and the Midlist author and ebooks and all of that. And that was really, really interesting because Justina was on it and Ellen and Kate Elfman, who knows so much about ebooks.
Yes.
And it was really interesting, and there was a lot of audience discussion and some railing and gnashing of teeth. It was a lot of fun. I mean, I think that's probably been my highlight of the panels. But yeah, just in general, catching up with people.
Yeah,
and meeting people I've never actually met before. It's, yeah, people you kind of correspond with, and then after a few years, it's like, oh, there you are.
So oh, you look like this.
A little different to what I expected.
No one is as tall as I imagine them.
I build a physical picture of someone according to the esteem in which I hold them.
Yes, and then everyone is shorter.
Everyone is almost invariably shorter than my esteem.
I have the same problem. Yeah. Told someone the other day, you're as tall as I imagined, and they went, huh? So I guess start with your first novel, which is Madigan Mine, which came out last year.
Yeah.
And I wondered if you wanted to tell us a bit about
About the book itself, or
sure,
the writing of the book?
The book
itself. Madigan Mine's about a young man who's not particularly well equipped for life. He's just kind of muddling through. He's 20-something and doesn't really know what he's doing, and has lived his entire sort of teenage and early adult life with the memory of this girl who he was very much in love with, and in love with her mother and her family and that whole, because she's quite wealthy, and he came from very lower middle class home. So it's her, it's her family, it's her life. All of that was kind of in the back of his mind, and she and her family moved away when they were both quite young. And there's been this sort of shadow hanging over him, and she comes back into his life, and she's not the nice girl he remembers. She was never the nice girl he remembers. And yeah, she sort of turns his life upside down, and it's not a spoiler, but she eventually commits suicide, but that's actually the book opens at her funeral. So,
yeah.
So there's a bit of the back history woven through, and then the front story is what's happening now that she is dead, and she's very much still in his life and messing it up.
So, and perhaps his perception versus reality, as we discover,
yeah,
that she was never that nice.
She was never.
And what he thought was going on was never really the situation.
Yeah.
So they are two separate stories cut into each other. Did you write them separately, or did you write them?
No. In fact, it's. I have always written in an extremely linear form, and I've written stories where it looks like I may have written parts separately, but I honestly can't remember a single thing I've written that I haven't written from start to finish.
Okay.
And I might go back and say this scene needs to be reworked, or actually I need to add a bit more information because I've done something at the end. But I always pretty much write start to finish,
That flips back and forwards. So in your mind, you're flipping backwards and forwards as you wrote that.
As I'm writing that, there was that particular manuscript. I swapped out a scene in edits later with my publisher when there was one scene that they quite rightly picked up as a bit of a cheat.
Oh, okay.
And they said, yeah, it's a great scene, but it doesn't really, like, that can't work, can it? It's like, no. So I had to take that out and put a replacement scene in to give the same effect, but which actually worked with the way Madigan works.
So did you plan that all out then? If you write linearly, you know exactly where you're going and how you're getting there, or?
No, I know where I'm going. It might not always be where I end up,
right?
But I know where I'm going. And it took me a long time to accept the way I write, and to trust that the way I write works, because I have a very vague idea of where I'm going. Before I start anything, I have a beginning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a first line, which is really important for me. I find it really hard to... Although the first line, as it currently exists in Madigan, was not the first line when I originally wrote it and the publisher bought it, so that did change. But, yeah, I have a start, I have a vague end point, and mm-hmm. I know kind of where I need to go and what vague direction to get to that end point. And then what I find is when I'm writing, stuff happens that I... And a little detail sometimes that I've thrown in for colour, and then I'll get to the next scene or the next chapter, and it's like, oh, wait, that's... And I never know whether it's something that I have subconsciously planned ahead of time
mm-hmm.
or whether my brain's worked backwards and has processed the stuff I've written and gone, oh, that can be used like this.
These are the tools I have, yeah. And I'm going
to... And I never really know how that works. And it took me a long time to trust that I don't... Because I'm not a planner, but mm-hmm. I always felt that I should plan.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it took a long time to trust that I can just write
mm-hmm.
and it will work, and I will write my way into the story, and it will just work. It will work. And I'm a good enough writer now to trust that I can do that. So that's why.
So how long would you say that it took you to get to that point where you're like, well, this is not necessarily the way everybody else, you know, it's all very, you must plan and think and get to the point where you can trust it? Would it be
a lot of years.
At the point where you sold this novel? Or
no, afterwards. In fact, the novel I'm writing now, the second novel, I went through a whole thing where I bought coloured post-it notes and I put a great big sheet of butcher's paper up on the wall. I'm going to plan this one. The characters will have different colours and I'll plan it out. And then when I go to write it, it'll be easy because it'll just be, okay, what's next? That one. Awesome. Great. And I... No, I've still got the poem post-it notes.
Go back later and see what
happens. So I still think, I wish I could write faster, I wish I could do... I went to a panel this morning about Clarion,
mm-hmm.
and I've never done Clarion, I've never applied to do Clarion, because I, as much as I kind of love to, and I love the idea of it, I'm too slow, I don't think I could write like that. But it's not... It's not the day-to-day speed, because I think I don't spend any more time mm-hmm. on a manuscript than a writer who redrafts it 10 times.
Right.
But I kind of write it once, and then it's done, bar tweaking. And unless I'm completely messed up and there's some terrible structural problem, it's kind of done.
It's just a different process
yeah,
to that
yeah.
one.
And I just edit as I go. I rewrite and edit as I go, and on a copy level and on a structural level as I go. Mm. And sometimes something will sit there for a couple of weeks without having been touched, because I need to work out what the next scene is or the next place I have to go.
Because you write linearly. Yeah.
And then it's done. And then it's done, and so it's good.
So do you write every day? Are you a manic, must write certain number of words per day?
No, I think I should be.
Shoulds in this conversation.
Exactly, because I still have in my head, this is what you have. Because you hear, you go to seminar, you go to places like SwanCon, you sit at panels, you talk to other people, it's like, you have to write every day, you have to get into the habit, you have to do it. And I kind of do. What I realise is that I think about writing every day.
Uh-huh.
And I don't mean that in a facetious, like, I should write.
No.
Like, I will... think about the story and the characters and where they're going and the themes and things I have to draw out. And so I may not put words down on the screen every day, but I'll spend hours while I'm doing other things sometimes thinking about the story and where it needs to go.
So that when you next sit down, you're just writing because you already know where you're going.
And those words are done. I'm not going to have to go back to them because I've changed my mind.
So it seems quite efficient to me.
I think it's efficient, and I look at it, the analogy that there's two analogies I use depending how I'm... Actually, the finding of ideas, I have very much like a junkyard thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I pick up bits and pieces, and I never really know where they're going to go. And then every so often it's like, oh, these two bits go together. Great, I'll leave them over there. And then I'll find a third bit. It's like, that's the story. Great, I can write that. And that might be years.
Yeah.
I can carry bits around for years. So that's kind of the finding of the story process. But the making of the story is more like, and I don't knit, I don't crochet
mm-hmm.
or do a lot. I do make chainmail, which mm-hmm. I guess is a similar thing. But I've always sort of, the way I write as being like, knitting or crocheting, where it's intricate and you have to go and you can't stop this because it's a bit hard and you'd rather get to that part of the pattern. You've just got to keep going. And mm-hmm. if you make a mistake back here, that's going to mess up here. So you need to make sure you get it right as you go.
I really love that.
And that's And that's how I write, which is why it's almost traumatising sometimes to think about if there's a structural edit needed, because I've got to unpick
all those No.
But it's never that hard. It's never that hard as I think about it in my head.
Because it's not a one piece of yarn.
It is not a one piece, that's right. You don't pick one string and the whole thing unravels.
No.
You can actually put bits
Hopefully.
In. So maybe it's more like a patchwork quilt. And you can always add a patch.
Yep. Yep. Oh, I like that. And I guess I want to talk about the next book that you're writing, but probably before that, I'd love to know where you place yourself genre-wise, sort of in terms of the horror or the not horror, whether you see yourself...
It's really, really hard, and I think 10 years ago I would have said I'm definitely a horror writer. It's mostly what I write. It's not mostly what I read. I've never only read or even mostly read horror. I've always read really widely in through genre and mainstream and a lot of stuff. But I've always through everything that I read, there's always sort of the darker side of things. So that's probably what I'm drawn to more than a genre. It's the tone of work.
What appeals to you about that? It's very sinister and very...
It's...
cynical, almost.
Well, I'm not... Yeah, cynical, definitely. I think what it is, I think part of it is... I definitely have something within me that pushes against what's accepted and status quo and the idea of what's okay to be... And because I never want to... I don't like getting told what's okay... To be, to watch, to want. And I might get to the point where I decide, that is not okay. But
right.
I want to have gotten to the point where
on your
I've
own.
Decided that particular, whatever it is actually not good. And you see so much of stuff that you're told isn't correct, isn't right. And most of that's just horrible and vile. And it's fine. It's just people don't like it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of what I like is well, you know, if there is a taboo against something, why is there a taboo against something? Should there be a taboo against it? What is it about this thing or this, you know, this person or this act or whatever it is that is a taboo? And most of the time, it's very arbitrary. So I'm kind of drawn to what people don't like to talk about, and to look at why people don't like to talk about it. And very often it's just really interesting and fascinating and complex, and maybe that's why people don't like to talk about it, because it's not black and white.
It's
really easy to say, you know, I mean, death is a big one, obviously, and we have so many taboos around death, a lot of which we really shouldn't. And I think death is really complex, and it's really hard to sort of address, and I deal with a lot of it in my fiction. I mean, death is kind of this spectre that hangs over everything, death and bodily loss of control over your body,
right.
and things that happen to you.
Yeah.
And all of that, I think whenever we talk about the body, it always becomes really icky. And it really shouldn't. Death and illness and disfiguration and people who are different to most people, it always becomes this topic where you don't want to talk about it, you don't want to look at it, and it shouldn't be. It's and that goes inside as well. So psychology is, I don't know.
Well, I guess as I'm listening to that, because I haven't finished Maddie in Mind, I tried really hard to read it in time, and I'm only halfway through.
You've been running a convention.
I know, and I have to tell you, I've been running a convention, and I can't put your book down.
Oh, that's great.
Actually, which... Worst time to be reading, I'm in there and I've got no concentration span, and it's what I'm reading.
Oh, good.
And that's really the central character, isn't it? She's broken inside and nobody wants to talk about
she's
it.
She's absolutely broken.
And she hasn't been able to tell anybody about it. And I'm only halfway through, so I don't know where we're going to go. But it's quite clear that everybody around her has realised that they aren't getting the whole story, but they know that there's something.
Yeah. And she is broken, and... And the things that she does, they're not forgivable. They're not.
No, because
you don't get around them.
Just because you're broken doesn't excuse you from your behaviour.
And she's broken, but she's highly functional.
Oh yeah.
So
is that like a level of sociopath?
Oh, she's yeah. She's definitely well. She has a lot of sociopathic tendencies. She's also, I don't know how far you've gotten, I don't know if you've gotten to the bit with her in Berlin that's in her past.
No.
Okay. There is a section at the end where it's from her point of view, and it's just about when she was in Berlin before she came back and was with Alex again. And that was one of the bits of the novel that my editor was sort of, I don't know if we need that in there. I don't know that it's doing anything. And it did get rewritten, more in terms of the tone of it rather than anything that happened in it. And it was in there to give her some humanity that you might not have had, because the whole novel is the first person from Alex's point of view. So everything is his observation and his memory.
And his experience.
Yeah.
Which is always one-sided if it's not explained to you.
So I wanted to give her something that was hers. And I thought that's what it did. And it possibly didn't add to the story, but I think it added to her, and it made it less easy to dismiss her as just someone who's a sociopath who doesn't care, who never cared, who just uses people because she didn't. And she actually does love. It's just a really broken kind of love. So
it's uplifting, really.
No, it's not uplifting.
No, it's not.
It's not uplifting. It's definitely not uplifting. I don't do uplifting. It's really, I've tried. In short form, I've tried to write happier stories. They never work out. It's very sad.
That's actually probably where I wanted to go now, is to talk maybe more about your short fiction. Somebody told me that on a panel you said that you sold your novel on the basis of your short fiction.
Yeah, I did.
And in researching this, I went back to check out everything that you'd written. Obviously, Painlessness was really well received recently.
Yeah.
And you've got a 12 planet, so I've sort of seen a bit of that. And trying to think about whether any of that's uplifting. But having said that,
one of the stories you have, I think does have a happy ending. It depends how you read it, but the one that I did write, this is a really happy ending. It's not a conventional ending, but
I think what's funny is that I think uplifting and happy doesn't necessarily have to come from the ending itself, but what you get out of reading it.
Yeah.
And firstly, being able to explore certain topics that are taboo and that people don't talk about. And suddenly finding somebody else wanting to discuss or even raise a particular issue.
Yeah.
Even the discussion can be uplifting.
Yeah.
Just airing it. I don't know, I often feel quite, when you can engage with something, that process is uplifting, and being able to have a very strong female writer writing about very strong female issues that are taboo or are swept away is an exciting thing in itself. And they're grim.
They are grim. I think because also I think I'm quite realistic, and I'm not sure I can
cope with like a happy unicorn bouncing around in the sky written by Kirsten MacDonald. That wouldn't go well.
But I think most of the stories that get told in, like real stories that happen to real people, most of them, well, they all end in death for a start.
Right.
A lot of them end in death. It's not just someone who passes away peacefully in their bed, fully compos mentis and with nothing wrong with them, and they just, like in Titanic, with the old lady passing away in her bed. It's a lovely ending. Maybe 1% of the population, probably less than 1% of the population, get that story.
Mm.
So we're all heading towards something that's not comforting. And I guess I'm a realist writer because I like, but I think we can.
That's
I think if we accept that as just part of the way it is, instead of railing against it and trying to prolong our lives and prolong the idea of youthfulness as some kind of inoculation against it, if we just accept that as cyclic, and this is what happens, and we don't get a happy story. We don't get
a complete happy story.
No, we have bits of happiness, we have bits of despair. Our story is not happily ever after, and it won't ever be happily ever after. Not our story, our individual story.
Mm.
I think the story of humans may get to be happy.
I don't think
maybe.
So.
Maybe. So you're worse than me. I'm not allowed to write dystopian science fiction because no one would want to read something that depressing.
So when Madigan Mine came out, there was a second novel that you'd also sold, but it's not a sequel.
No, it's not. And I was really surprised, actually, that Picador bought two novels.
Because it's
completely
quite
unrelated.
Yeah, that seemed very surprising. So that they really, in that, normally you might sell a trilogy or you might sell a sequel, but to sell
or
two.
A series.
And so had you submitted the second manuscript?
No.
The first one, and they bought the first one, and then...
Well, it's one of those stories I hate to tell, because I know if I was hearing it as a yet unpublished author, I'd want to kill me.
Right.
But no, what really happened was I had Madigan written, and it had been written quite a few years before in various iterations, and I'd actually just given up. It had been around a lot of publishers, and not Penn Macmillan, surprisingly.
Right.
And I said, that's it, I'm going to write short fiction now. And I had another novel I'd kind of started and was sort of tinkering about, and I decided to just... To leave that aside too and just write short fiction and not worry about it. And I got an email from a publisher at Picador saying he'd read some of my short fiction and did I have a novel?
Wow.
And, can he see my novel? And, and I said, how do you know I have a novel? And I have a novel because I wrote this stupid little biography that went at the back of every short story if they printed one that said, blah, 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 blah. Kirsten is living in Melbourne and working on a novel-length manuscript, and he wanted to see that novel-length manuscript.
So we've learned two things here. One, short stories are a very good advertisement for what you can do.
I think so.
And two, it's not about the cats. It's about the fact that you have a novel
that
in your bio.
That you are working on a novel-length manuscript. And
because that's what people are looking for when they read your bio.
So I sent him... I said, well, the one I'm working on isn't done yet, but I've got this other one. Would you like to see that? Sure, and so I sent it, and within 2 months he rung up and said we'd like to buy it, and I went and had lunch with him 2 or 3 days later, and he said, so what else are you working on? And I said, oh, this novel about this, and he went, yeah, that's really, I think we'd like to buy them both.
Wow.
So I had to write a synopsis for him to submit to purchasing, but he just...
So that's pretty exciting, that's a pretty exciting thing, that, hard work...
Yeah, it does.
Pays out.
I mean, it's lucky in one way, but it's only lucky because I'd done the work. And I did have a manuscript there, and I was working on another novel.
And that you are very talented at what you do.
And that it was a good manuscript.
It was good helped.
Exactly.
So the second novel, can you tell us anything about it?
It's about two sisters. It's the same... When I say set in the same world, it's set in our world.
Mm-hmm.
It's just tweaked a little. So there's something in there that's not reality. But it's, it's set in mostly in Melbourne, partially in Brisbane. And it's about two sisters. And it's a hard to kind of... But one of the sisters makes an imaginary friend.
Okay.
And...
It's similar
it's not
to
a very nice imaginary
ghost stories that aren't necessarily supernatural. Because Madigan Mine, she's a ghost, but she's not an actual ghost.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I love the idea of the liminal and stuff, which isn't, it doesn't fall one way or the other, and it's that sort of transitionary. So I've written a few ghost stories in the past couple of years, actually. I've become kind of a little obsessed with the ghost. Not the conventional type of horrible
French
thing happens, someone
thing,
goes hanging around, need to fix the problem,
right.
It's gone.
Yeah.
But the idea of what lingers behind a person, and I'm writing a story that I haven't been able to finish because I can't get around the heart of it, but the idea that we're the ones who create the ghosts, we keep the ghosts here, and if ghosts are real, we're creating them ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can't let go of the people who've gone, and in a bad way. It's not like we all want to be remembered,
right? The immortality,
but it's the not being able to let go that's really fascinating. So I don't, I have written a couple of out and out ghost stories, but it's just that idea of how we perceive people, how we remember people, what we want people to be, what happens when they're not the people we want them to be, all of which is in the new novel, I think, because she creates a person who doesn't end up being what... Well, he's kind of exactly what she wanted, but which then isn't what she wants. So...
Interesting.
Yeah.
I would be a bad interviewer if I didn't finish with the fact that you are a 12th planet rider.
Yes, I am.
And that I'd love to talk to you about that. And the question that I have is, how did you approach writing the 12th planet collection, which is actually Alex's question?
Because
from memory, you had a few...
I had a novella.
Yeah.
And it was such a problematic novella. I tried to fix it a lot because there were holes, there were bits that weren't working. It was such a long story and there wasn't a good enough payoff for the story. And I finally thought I'd fix it, but it's still a long novella. And where do you sell a novella? And
yeah.
I kind of put it aside and thought, well, one day there might be something. And then I had this other short story, which was called Horn, which was about... I had a unicorn in it, and I'd written it and finished it about, 2 or 3 months before you announced Peter Ball's Horn. I was like, oh, no. That one goes in a drawer. I'm going to leave that alone. And then when you invited me to submit to 12 Planets, I was like, well, I've got this novella about broken people,
mm-hmm.
and I've got this short story, Horn, which is very much about broken people and loss and is kind of a ghost story. And I thought, well, if anyone's going to publish a unicorn story from Horn, maybe it is 12 Planets. We can go a bit meta on the whole thing.
Yeah.
And so then I wrote the third story, which had been hanging around in my head for a long, long time, and I'd started it and gotten to a point where I didn't know. Now, I knew where I wanted to take it, and I had to be so careful about the way it was written because of the subject matter and the... wanting to avoid blaming the wrong character for something that happened in the story.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that's the one that would actually link these two together. So I wrote that, and then I didn't have time to write the fourth, but I had the idea
mm-hmm.
for what the fourth one would be, and that... So it's the broken people.
That's the theme, broken people.
Maybe the name. But broken people, and then I think... almost every one of the stories, there's notes of optimism in the story. So they're not all... maybe not Horn. That's pretty... that's not... no, there's no optimism there. But the other two, and the fourth one that I'm going to be writing, which I think... I mean, if you agree, obviously, when you're editing it, but I think will probably be the last
mm-hmm.
story, because I think that's going to be still dark and icky and kind of broken, but I think that will be the one that has the most optimistic ending.
Yeah, I don't want to, like, you know, that cynicism and grimness. I mean, I think that...
I don't know if there's a lot of cynicism in my work.
I don't think...
I'm very cynical, but I don't know that I let it get into my work a lot. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, in terms of... because if you show the darker side of people, it makes them truer and it makes them deeper and more interesting and complex.
Yeah.
But it's also harder to redeem... flawed people, because you're flawed. You can never be the perfect hero.
Well, but this is the thing, and I think more than anything else, what I really like exploring and writing about is characters who are flawed and broken, and they get to have a story, and most of the time they don't die,
mm-hmm.
and they get to find some place where they can be flawed and broken, and but still be. And I think we get to have that. We can be who we are, and we don't have to be the perfect person. And it's really hard for most people to kind of
navigate that because space. We aren't a perfect person,
no,
and that's
but we all want to be.
Where the optimism
we all
is.
Want to be. You know, we want to be smarter. We want to be more organized. We want to be thinner. We want to have more friends. We want to do. We want to be richer. We all want this more stuff, which will make us better people
mm-hmm.
and perfect
yeah.
people. And the people we're meant to look up to are meant to be perfect. And I find that kind of boring. And also really sad that we then ostracise and demonise the imperfect.
Mm.
And the imperfect is beautiful. So
thank you very much for that. And thank you for talking with us today on Galactic Chat.
Thank you.
And we can find more of your work from your website?
Yeah, I've got links to anything which is online, and there's a link to where you can buy my novel. I mean, you can buy my novel
anywhere.
I do recommend Boomerang Books. I think in Australia they're really, really good for if you're buying online as opposed
mm-hmm.
to going into a bookshop.
Yep.
They're really good, and they definitely have the book, and there's a small discount as well. So,
cool. Thank you very much.
No worries. Thank you.